You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, October 19th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And we have a guest rogue this week, Brian Trent. Brian, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks so much.
Hey, Brian.
Hey.
Brian, how long? It's been, what, a couple years since you were on?
It's been a little while. Last time we spoke, I believe, was about longevity research. And it's the technological angles and the sociological angles.
And we talked about your book, I remember, Remembering Hypatia.
Going back, which actually was republished by Fireship Press as Lady Philosopher. So it is out there, new and improved, but it still deals with Alexandria and the importance of reason over superstition.
Very nice. And what have you been doing recently to keep busy?
A lot of freelance work, working on other books and actually getting into films as well. So, and listening to you guys.
You're a Renaissance man.
Smart guy. Born in the wrong century.
Right. And Rebecca, welcome back from TAM London. You weren't really gone since you live over there in England, but you were at TAM London this past weekend.
I was, in fact, at TAM London, the second TAM London, and huge success. It was a triumph.
How many people?
There were
27,
people,
right?
Oh, I believe. Yeah, it's just three or four of us hanging out in my living room. No, I think we had about 1,000 people, I think.
Sweet.
Awesome. The venue was filled. Yeah, it was wonderful. And Randy made it out.
Yay.
Plus, yeah, and he was in fine form, on stage quite a bit, and we interviewed him for Little Adams, and I saw my good friend John Ronson, who did he rapped Insane Clown Posse lyrics while Tim mentioned beatboxed, which was honestly worth the price of admission on its own.
Wow, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. Oh, and I should also mention we had. Do you remember we had Reese on the show who was
you met him?
Crohn's disease. Not only did I meet Reese, and just to remind our audience.
But he drove you around London and gave you a tour of the country, right?
He's a child, Jay.
I know, but he's so smart that kid's probably running the government by now.
to remind our audience, Reese is the one who has Crohn's disease and debunked someone who is basically selling bleach to cure it. And so he was fighting against this guy on forums for people suffering from Crohn's disease. Reese won an award from Randy for grassroots activism.
Excellent.
So he got to go on stage and accept an
Excellent.
Award. And it was really adorable. He was beaming ear
awesome.
To ear.
So, yeah. That's awesome.
Really cool.
Well, I'm really proud of him.
Yeah. I was very proud of him, too. And it was really fun to see him afterwards. I saw him in the green room and surrounded by all the other speakers who were all clamoring to talk to him.
Yeah.
And I hadn't said anything to him yet. And I had to wait for one of the other speakers to finish gushing to him. So
what are we going to do about this TAM thing? Like, we got TAM 3 London's coming up. TAM 9 Vegas, TAM Oz 1. What else?
TAM Rebecca's living room.
that was a private party, if you know what I mean.
What about yesterday, Rebecca?
Well, that's the other reason why I haven't gotten a whole lot of sleep, is that yesterday was my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
What are you, 20 now?
Cumpleaños. That was my 30th.
The big 3-0.
Oh, whoa. New decade.
I don't know. I'm looking forward to 34 because last night my friend Winslow said out of nowhere, he's like, hey, just 4 more years until you've outlived Jesus, allegedly. So,
33
I like that as a
marker. Is a year when religious icons and rock stars and comedians tend to die.
Alexander the Great died at 33.
Yeah.
And Jimi Hendrix, I think. And
Bruce Lee was 32.
But 34 was James Kirk's age when he was captain of the Enterprise, though.
That's right.
Oh, well, that is it. Yeah.
And how kick-ass is that? Yeah. So you got that to look forward to.
Yeah, I am looking forward to being captain of the Enterprise.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine that ship?
It's It's like everybody on their 34th birthday gets one go on the Enterprise.
If Rebecca ran the Enterprise, what would it be like? It'd be like people
we'd be
getting up at like
planet all
one
the
in the afternoon. She's like, yeah, go to that planet over there. Well,
no, you know that sexy planet they go to where it's just...
Ryza?
Yeah,
that's
the one. Our slogan would be to boldly explore Ryza every day.
Well, we actually have some news items to get to this week. We're going to start with a downer. Unfortunately, Benoit Mandelbrot passed away last week.
Yeah, I saw that.
Bob, you got to tell
us. Yeah,
that
was a bummer.
In my head, I always call him Benoit.
Benoit?
Oh, my God. I used to as well until I
I don't think I've ever said it out loud, luckily.
I remember years ago, I was really into those beautiful mathematical shapes called fractals. And I did a lot of reading about them. And if you study these things, even casually, a gentleman called Benoit Mandelbrot will invariably turn up in your Google searches, although I don't think Google existed when I was into it. But Mandelbrot was the Sterling Professor Emeritus of Mathematical Science at Yale University, Steve.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
You never mentioned that he was there. Did you ever see him, or was he near you?
I used
you?
To pass him in the hall all the time. We'd say hi. We'd chat about fractals. Different
part, sure, his autograph.
Different part
and
of
was
the
his
university,
autograph,
Bob.
Like a tiny autograph inside of it?
He signed his name in 1,000 little pieces. So that was before he retired, and he coined the term fractals and brought them to the masses. In his 1982 seminal book, The Fractal Geometry of Nature, he described these mathematical objects, which are virtually ignored by mainstream scientists who call them monstrous and pathological. So why am I talking about this guy? Well, primarily, as Steve said, he's dead. And I'm sure if he was still alive today, I'd be talking about some nanoquark AI solar doodad thing instead. But I've wanted to talk about this stuff for a while, so I'm sorry it took his death to motivate me, but better late than never. So what are fractals? I'm sure a lot of people know what they are, but I'm sure a lot don't. Most people would recognize them as those complex, beautiful, computer-generated shapes you see on T-shirts or at conventions maybe. They were really, really popular, I guess, in the 80s and 90s. But they're essentially, fractals are geometric shapes, whether natural or they can be created from equations, that have an attribute called self-similarity. Now, that means that tiny pieces of the shape look like the whole thing. So at any scale then, from very far away or zoomed in really, really close, you're going to see similar shapes repeating themselves over and over. So a classic example for me anyway is a tree. I mean, look at a branch. You look at a tree, then you look at a branch, and it kind of looks like the whole tree. And then you look at a smaller branch, and that looks similar as well. Even the twig on the branch kind of looks like a little tree. It's simpler, of course, but it's still very similar. So it turns out that these shapes, once they can be mathematically described and manipulated, they can be used to describe and understand complex shapes found in nature, the shapes of like clouds and mountains and coastlines. The
coastlines, exactly. He had that paper, How Long is the Coast of Britain? Because I'm actually a fellow Mandelbrot fan. I mean, I've liked the guy's work for a long time, and the self-similarity, you can even see how when you get down to the precise measurements of a coastline. He said, well, you know, the smaller your measurement is, the longer that the measured length is. So like you said, with the trees, with mountains, clouds, and so forth.
Well, that's a great point, because and that was one of the topics that I think really got him, that kind of started him on his epiphany of fractals, and when he was looking into this deeply in the 60s. I mean, he asked himself a simple question: how long is the coastline of Great Britain? And it sounds like a very easy question, right? But it's not. Think about it. The length depends on the size of the ruler you're using or how magnified the map that you're using is. So a small map would yield one estimate. But if you had a much bigger map or a much, much smaller ruler that you were using, then all these nooks and crannies would reveal themselves, and the coast gets longer and longer the more magnified it is and the smaller your ruler is.
It's kind of like Zeno's paradox. You remember Zeno's paradox
in
Greek philosophy?
Yeah, you keep going
like,
half the distance,
right?
And half the distance.
Exactly.
Kind
it reminds
of.
Reminds me of a precursor.
It is similar to that. Actually, Mandelbrot said that a coastline could be considered infinite when you look at it this way. So what number is correct then? How long is the coast of Britain? And if you looked in encyclopedias years ago, you would see greatly, wildly divergent estimates on actually how long the coastline is. So this kind of leads into another key property of fractals then, is just the idea of fractal dimension. Tiny, if you look at a coastline, tiny pieces of it look like much longer stretches of the coastline. So the shape, it's not a one-dimensional line. It's not a two-dimensional surface like a table. It's kind of somewhere in between, right? So fractals then, like coastlines, can be calculated to have a fractional dimension. And for Great Britain, it's actually a 1.25. It's got a fractional dimension of 1.25. And this number applies to the coastline at all scales. So the fractal image is composed of tiny bits of the whole, the fractional dimension, the fractal dimensions is the same. No matter what scale you look at it, it would always be measured at about 1.25 for that specific piece of coastline. So the point, though, is that once you determine the fractal dimension of the coastline, you could then calculate a meaningful length for the coast based on that dimension. And that, of course, is very helpful. Fractal shapes, I mean, Mandelbrot didn't just think of all this himself. I mean, fractal shapes have been known and examined mathematically well before him, even going back to the 17th century. Even Da Vinci tried to deal with some of these non-Euclidean shapes.
What does Euclidean mean?
But Euclidean is basically just the geometry that you know of triangles and cones and spheres, just the basic stuff that's not the fractal shapes, the complicated curvy shapes that we know as fractals.
Right, and that's why I used to try to square the circles and so forth. Everything was based in a Euclidean way.
Right.
Which is why, it's popular in fantasy, too, when they talk about non-Euclidean, like H.P. Lovecraft and writers like that. They try to get away from the shapes and sizes that we know.
Why is the Mandelbrot the one that you really associate with him? It's kind of like a mirror image of itself, and it looks like kind of almost like
the Mandelbrot set.
Yeah, why is that shape?
Yeah.
That way?
Well, he discovered. I mean, before him, there was a gentleman named Julia had come up with these Julia sets, which are with these beautiful fractals. But what Mandelbrot did was to take all those Julia sets and he kind of put them all together. And when he put them all together mathematically, he came up with his Mandelbrot set, which for me is the most amazing fractal. I recommend anyone who's never seen it just to Google that and just to look at those images, or even get a fractal generating program and you could zoom in. It's like a landscape of a continent. You can just zoom into the tiniest piece and see this wonderful complexity and symmetry, and it's just it's amazing to look at.
It's eternity. It's infinity. It's like the Sierpinski triangles, the ones
yeah.
you keep. The
yeah.
more you zoom in, it goes on forever, like a hall of mirrors.
Right. They are considered, infinitely complex in a general sense, because, equations can generate these. And you could just, if you've got a powerful enough computer, you can generate amazing detail at any scale, really. But it's not just for pretty pictures, though. Mandelbrot and his insights have helped with a wide array of topics, including network architectures like the internet, diagnosing diseases, financial markets, compression algorithms, the way galaxies cluster, even how the mammalian brains fold as they grow. Heinz Otto Peintgen is a professor of mathematics at the University of Bremen. He said, if we talk about impact inside mathematics and applications in the science, he's one of the most important figures of the last 50 years. So if you're interested, check him out. And it's pretty amazing stuff. I loved it.
And the pictures are pretty.
there's a mathematician who actually got cool. He was on every college, every psychedelic college dormitory room. People, you always saw that distinctly like beetle-like Mandelbrot shape all over the place.
Yeah. Let's go on. Actually, Brian, you're going to give us a quick update on stem cell research funding in the U.S.
Well, there was an important piece of information. I mean, obviously, in a political year, this always comes up, and especially this year. Everything has been politicized, and stem cells have been one of the hot topics for, as everybody knows, at least a decade now. And there was an appeals court, the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, that put on hold an order that cut off funding from a U.S. district judge. It was essentially scientists are being allowed to use embryonic stem cells for research, and they can continue to receive U.S. taxpayer funding while the government challenges a lower court order. So that court order, of course, is the one that barred federal support. And while this is going on, there was a question. A lot of scientists are worried about losing their jobs. And while this is being challenged, they are going to continue to use the stem cells. They're allowed to still use it and to receive taxpayer funding. And, the argument that was made is that, lifting the ban It allows us to continue making important progress on Parkinson's, spinal cord injuries especially, genetic conditions. This involves embryonic stem cells, which is the major hook of why it's so politicized now. And it ties into a lot of the rhetoric we're hearing. People are worried about everything from cloning and abortion, and actually recently Christine O'Donnell made that comment about fully functioning human brains in mice. I don't know if people noticed that. But, of course, no, that's, none of that stuff is going on. This is about actually doing research to try to cure some important diseases today.
Now, this all goes back to Dickie Wicker, right?
Dickie Wicker, what? Dickie Wicker is one of the big with the names. How often do you get to say that name, exactly?
Yeah, can we all just say that? Dickie Wicker.
That sounds like a product.
Okay. Thank you.
This is the original 1996...
Dickie Wicker Amendment.
Amendment, yeah. This is actually passed by Congress. Like, a lot of people misunderstand this. You know, Bush didn't initiate a ban on stem cell research. It was the Congress passed this amendment in 1996. But what Bush was doing was just interpreting that ban. Essentially, the ban was against any research that would cause a human embryo to be destroyed. And the question was, how does that apply to stem cell research? And the executive order from the Bush administration in 2001 was to say that, well, you could do research on existing lines, even if they were
presidential lines, which were mostly useless, I believe. A lot of them were bad.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. There were about 20 – I know there were about 20 existing lines, if I remember. And that's at least what – when Bush's order came down in August of 2001, he said, okay, I'm allowing research on about 20 lines. But – there's been a lot of debate about that. I mean, 20 lines is what they said and to put out there to make it seem like a compromise, but it was far fewer than that that were actually viable. So for all intents and purposes, it really did tie a lot of scientists' hands, and it really did contribute to America falling way, way behind. People don't understand how fast, you know, a global superpower in terms of technology and research and science can become a global sick man very, very quickly in an era in which collective knowledge in the planet doubles and so consistently. And so 2001, the order came down, and it was postured as a compromise, but it was less than 20 lines.
The enforcement of that was actually very draconian. The bottom line was it absolutely was systematically shutting down stem cell research in the United States. And then
withholding funding, right?
Yeah.
So how far behind are we, guys? Not just in years, but – you know, with, like Brian was saying, it snowballed. Like, it got, the other countries that were working on it got more efficient and faster, and the research just kept progressing. And now we're basically starting from, you know, where they were, what, 10, 12 years ago?
We're strictly in a catch-up mode right now. And, I mean, at least we're – I wouldn't say we're catching up. We're – if this goes through right now, if the U.S. Court of Appeals and this situation plays out the way we want it to, we will then be catching up. But right now, it's damage control on the books. People don't quite understand. When you look at the way antibiotics completely transformed medicine and what a revolution that is, I mean, there's so much rhetoric done to cater to a lot of like low-info constituencies that talk about how, well, stem cells haven't done anything. Well, no, they are doing a lot of things, but they're doing it in places like South Korea. They're not doing it here.
Yeah.
And there's some. It's one of the most important issues, and it really cannot be overstated right now.
Well, it's also, I think, that people's attention spans are really short. And collectively, you know, culturally, our attention spans are short. So people
are...
Well,
it's not sexy either, right.
Yeah, the thing, stem cells, they're going to cure all these diseases. Then like 2-3 years later, like, hey, how come stem cells haven't cured all these diseases yet? I guess that was all, you know, just pie in the sky. It's kind of like the Genome Project, right? People are saying, hey, how come the Genome Project hasn't resulted in all of these cures and everything? Well, that's because the hype always overestimates short-term progress. And people are thinking, you know... It should be – these things should be here already, and scientific research is a long investment on the future, but it takes, you know, 10, 20 years longer than people realize to translate these kind of basic science research that we're talking about into actual applications. So it's the kind of thing where, yeah, you know, it's going to be really a generation before we start to see a lot – these applications come to fruition.
But who's doing that talking, Steve? That's the thing. You know, we had one of the most important things, and one of the reasons that, you know, I love this show is that we're actually trying to get that message across to people. If you don't have someone conveying exactly what you said, then people are – the media only reports what is sexy. If, if it bleeds, it leads. And it, they lose interest fast. And but this has very real ramifications. I mean, you have so many people dying from cancer and from diabetes and from heart disease, things that are actually – statistically going to get you.
Yeah.
As opposed to other things that we spend, you know, millions, billions, trillions of dollars on. So
I think a good example that people might be able to wrap their heads around is like is the internet. Think about the internet in the 70s and even in the 80s. And then when people started to first realize what the promise of the internet was, they thought that all of that promise was going to come to fruition in the 90s. And that partly created the tech bubble of the 90s. And that bubble popped because it didn't manifest in the 90s. But you know what? In 2010, it pretty much has. You know, it just took 10 more years than everybody really thought it was supposed to take. But now we have all of the kind of social networking and business tools and other things. Yeah, not fully manifest, but, you know, the kind of things people were talking about and were expecting to happen in the 90s just took another 10 years.
Yeah, I was waiting for basically the iPhone. That was the invention. Right? Right. I wanted a computer in my hand that I could do all my stuff on. That's it.
Right. That's true. I want
it in my head.
Let's go on to the next news item. This one is one of the most emailed items to us in the last week or so, and this has been getting a lot of discussion on the interwebs. An article published claiming that cancer is a modern disease.
Cancer.
And offering as evidence for this a review of paleontological evidence and also the evidence from the many mummies that have been uncovered around the world, saying that there is essentially no evidence in these mummies and other paleontological evidence for cancer in the ancient world. And therefore, the authors conclude, cancer is a modern man-made disease. It's a result of our lifestyle choices and living in modern society.
This sounds suspiciously like that thing that went around a few years ago about how sharks don't get cancer, so we should all act like sharks or something. So
I'm guessing
that's the next thing is like mummies don't get cancer, so let's all pull our brains out through our nose.
Well, the shark thing was that was the justification for shark cartilage cancer cures, right? Which of course sharks do get cancer. They get cancer of the cartilage, in fact.
Well, you know, one thing, too, is we didn't live as long. I mean, we have a definitely extended human longevity, and I think that's definitely got to be a factor that we have to consider here with this story. I mean, you didn't have people reaching 80, 90, 100 years old in ancient Egypt and ancient Greece and so forth. So I think that has to – I don't know if that was considered.
It was, but it's a complicated point. So the age range of the mummies was from between about 25 to 50 years old. That's young, right?
Yeah.
Cancer risk really takes off with age. It's really a disease of people over 50 in a lot of ways. There are obviously cancers that do strike younger. The authors said they took that into consideration, but they argued that there are some cancers like bone cancer, which do hit younger populations, and the fact that they couldn't find examples of these younger cancers in the mummies that they were examining is evidence that it didn't exist.
Yeah, but how many mummies are there? I mean, are there – you know, dozens?
Thousands.
Or thousands?
No, thousands. Yeah.
Okay,
thousands.
I have a question. Did it occur to any of you guys that when they make a mummy, they take out the internal organs in the brain?
Yes.
So there you go.
Do they open up canopic jars? I mean,
they take out most of the organs. They actually put into separate jars, which are then also mummified. So we still have those organs. And the brains were discarded, so obviously wouldn't know much about brain cancer unless it affected
the skull. Useless material.
Yeah.
Did they really think that was just junk up there? Like what?
They thought it was junk because the seat of the soul for the Egyptians, your ba and your ka and all the different shades of the soul was the center of your chest. So isn't that ironic?
Yeah.
They threw out the most important part where they were trying to go for this preservation. They just tossed it away with the trash.
Yeah, but you'd figure that they would have found out eventually that if someone sustained a blow to the head hard enough that their personality was altered or they were, you know, had some type of brain damage, which in effect changed them. Wouldn't they have realized that? I find that so weird.
Well, that would be a curse. Anubis is cursing you. You had, you know, the forces of Apophis were zipping in and punishing you. So I don't think a lot of the connections were made.
Yeah, you can't think like a 21st century person.
Oh, all right. Well, forgive me. Sorry.
Impose that. Meaning you can't impose that upon people who lived 3,000 years ago. So they're making a huge speculative leap from essentially the lack of evidence, the not finding evidence for cancer. I don't know. I'm not convinced that they adequately took into consideration the whole issue of age. I think that the fact that younger people do not get cancer may in fact be an adequate explanation for this. We have documented history of the existence and knowledge of cancer in ancient civilizations. The word cancer,
that's irrelevant.
The word cancer was coined by Hippocrates.
Cancerous?
Hippocrates. Do you know what cancer means, by the way?
Yes.
Crab.
Yeah. Right. And that word was used because a malignant tumor kind of spreads around. It looks like a crab, with its tendrils spreading into surrounding tissue. They were able to distinguish benign versus malignant tumors. They recognized that they were untreatable, that breast cancer was the most common type. There are documentation from about 1500 to 2000 BCE in Egyptian papyrus of various cases of tumors of the breast, for example. So, it's hard to argue that it didn't exist in the ancient world when there's pretty much direct documentation that it did exist. It was known entity. It was named. There was actual medical information about it, mostly wrong. But so the notion that cancer did not exist in the ancient societies is absurd. The survey of mummies, itself may be interesting and well done technically science.
I like the idea of a mummy survey.
Mummy survey
in a room, maybe behind one way glass, with executives on the other side, and they're asking them questions, and they're all like,
"You've been living in England too long, Rebecca." Mummy.
Well, mummies definitely have their own little noise. It's more of like a muffled moan, right? It's not so much the zombie,
situation. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm confusing my horror monsters. Yeah.
Well, I just want to make sure.
Thanks for keeping it real, Jay.
Right.
It is the month of Halloween, Bob. I can't let shit like this slide.
No.
I'm sorry, but...
Dude, I'm glad somebody did it.
And zombies have definitely taken the spotlight, so I think mummies have been ignored. I think they need to have their... maybe this story will bring it back,
The Curse of the Mummy series, three movies recently all about mummies, right? The Mummy?
Yeah, but he's more badass, and he's really not wrapped up. You know what I mean? It's not like a mummy rolling around with like toilet paper.
Some of those CG corpses were awesome.
There's also some of the mummies that were naturally mummified, right? It wasn't a deliberate process, but yes, it happens. You just need to have conditions appropriate to be desiccated, just like the McDonald's hamburger thing we talked about.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, if you put like a corpse on your windowsill in a relatively cool, dry room. I mean, you get free mummification right there.
Yeah, yeah. I've done that. I've done that.
We talked about that, I think, a year ago, that woman who died in her home by the shore in Spain and was found like 3 years later mummified on her couch. Remember that story?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
One more news item. Actually, Brian, you're going to talk about this one too, about two asteroids actually in the last week or so that buzzed pretty close to the Earth.
Yeah, it was last Tuesday, actually. There was a small asteroid. It was only about 6 meters, and it flew within 28,000 miles of the Earth. As a frame of reference, the moon is typically around 380,000 kilometers. So it was pretty close. It's considered a near miss, but it was pretty small as well. It drifted right by, and NASA was charting it. But it's one of those things, again, that we noticed as it's here. And the science, we have NASA's statement said that the small space rocks this size would burn up in our atmosphere and pose no ground danger at all. So there was no risk of any extinction level events, but I thought it was interesting. It was asteroid 2010 TD54. Gotta love how we name things today. And it flew, within 20,000 miles. But what I thought was interesting is there are asteroids that explode in the atmosphere. They're not really big. I'm not talking about the asteroid that exploded in Tunguska in 1908. But when they explode, is anyone concerned at all? You have a world that's wired for early detection for like nuclear explosions and nuclear launches and so forth. I just think that's something that doesn't often get talked about. This, like I said, this was not a huge asteroid. I mean, you had something on the level of Apophis. There are two Egyptian references in one show. Apophis is actually an asteroid as well as an evil Egyptian god, and it's supposedly going to become extremely close to the Earth in 2029. And if it doesn't hit us then, it will come around again in 2036, in which it will be either closer or end up kissing us directly. So yeah. It's just, you know, asteroids, I don't know how sexy they are in the media either, but it is something that it's we know that they've hit the world before. It doesn't happen as often as some people would like us to think, but it's something that, A, the subject of asteroids brings up the possibility of water. A lot of scientists now are suggesting that water ice might be very common in asteroids. Mm-hmm. B, some of the asteroids, the near-Earth asteroids, contain enough nickel and iron to equal our output for several million years, estimate at modern levels. So, and then of course, these the always the concern about an impact. It's one of our great threats to our own survival as a species. Is a lucky shot by an extraterrestrial impact.
How big is this one?
So, the one that just missed us is only about 6 meters wide. It didn't pose any specific threat. But Apophis is a planet killer.
But, so, you know, the asteroids of that size, the one that came within 26,000 miles of the Earth,
yeah.
Just reading the NASA site, it says that that basically happens every day. That's a daily yeah. event. And it just in looking this up, I saw like there's an article from National Geographic on September 8th that there were two similar asteroids in one day that were spotted. The only thing that's really newsy about this is that somebody actually saw them, not that they were there. This was one that was 10 meters passed within 50,000 miles, and another one that was 15 meters passing within 154,000 miles. So all within the orbit of the moon, you know, basically Earth grazers. But you know, even the 15-meter ones, that would burn up in the atmosphere. And
really? Maybe
you know, small meteorites would hit the Earth, but they wouldn't do any damage. You know, maybe they would destroy a car or something like that, one we talked about last week.
I just picture some of these things exploding. In 1908, we didn't have early detection. We didn't have nuclear power.
Right.
But in, you know, if one of them were to explode, say, over the Middle East or over Islamabad or Pakistan.
But you're talking about like a Tunguska size event? Is that what you're talking
about? I wonder how big it would have to be. I wonder if anyone was asking the question. It doesn't have to be Tunguska size, although obviously that would expedite
yeah.
things. But if it just exploded over the atmosphere in that area, is that something that's factored into our considerations?
Could that fool us into thinking that it was actually a nuclear
exactly.
detonation? Exactly.
It's something they don't often talk about.
Yet another reason why we should be tracking this stuff as much as we possibly can. I mean, these are events, potential events, but that could not only destroy a city or maybe start a nuclear war, but these are things that we can do something about. I mean, there's nothing we're going to do about a gamma ray burst or a supernova or a lot of these other events, but this is something we could actually do something about, and we're just not doing enough.
Well, let's go on to a few of your questions and emails. We actually are starting with a correction from that last week. This has to do with the science or fiction segment about the whale poop. You guys remember that one, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Well, apparently I was a little too hasty in my reading of the article, and I didn't notice the fact that this is the notion that the feces generated by whales provide a significant nitrogen pump from the deep ocean into the upper ocean where the fish are. And the paper said that the amount of nitrogen that's contributed to by the whale feces is greater than the contribution from rivers. And I misinterpreted that as talking about essentially the worldwide contribution of nitrogen into the oceans. But it really was only taking measurements and talking about one local area, specifically the Bay of Maine, and not true of collectively. You can't even really extrapolate from their work to say anything collectively about the world's ocean. So it's really just a local phenomenon.
Yeah, and you know, it was funny because Bob and I were talking afterwards, and we both said to each other that we didn't pick that one. You know, it was a confusion with that.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, that sucks. Too bad, Steve. But you could try again another time.
Yeah, that's true.
So just strike that from the list.
If you wish. You still missed the real fake, so forget that.
No.
It's tainted. It's all tainted, man.
It is tainted. Let's go on to another question. This one has to do with T-Rex red blood cells. This one comes from Alan Laird. in Ketchikan, Kalua, Kona, that I assume is in Hawaii. And Alan writes, flipping through channels, I saw a guy on stage talking animatedly to a large group of teenagers. It was called Maybe Science Facts, F-A-Q-S, and I think his name was, now I'm going to regret not Googling first, Greg Batchelor. He wasn't just talking anti-evolution. He was serious young Earth creationist, and it looked like the kids were lapping it up. He basically said the reason we don't see dinosaur and human bones in the same geological layers is because of different sedimentation rates. Yeah, that old canard. He did bring up a tyrannosaurus skeleton that had red blood cells in it, and that since all cellular elements should have been fossilized by then, according to evolutionists, the dating methods must be seriously flawed. Any thoughts? Sorry about this. I don't have access to a computer while temping here in AK, so I'm doing all of this on me iPod, and it takes forever. P.S. I'm listening to every episode, and I love you all. Next time anyone visits Hawaii Island, let me know, and I'll gladly be your personal tour guide. Mahalo. Well, mahalo, Alan.
Did he actually say on me iPod like a pirate? On me iPod.
Yes. Well, on M-U-H, on my iPod.
Oh, okay. That's acceptable.
Whatever. I don't know if it's a typo or if he's being cute. So this is an interesting story on a couple of different levels. This is something we've actually talked about before, the whole T-Rex protein hubbub. This is one of those items where when I first read it, I thought it was a pretty straightforward news item, and I didn't realize that there was a raging scientific controversy underneath it. And of course, then we were contacted by a researcher who's actually involved in this kind of research who sort of clued me in. Basically, what Alan's referring to is the research of Schweitzer, who is a paleontologist who also has developed some expertise in certain biological lab techniques. And Schweitzer is found in the inside the thigh bone of a T-Rex fossil. So what she claims is soft tissue from the T-Rex, including some red blood cells. And that hemoglobin, or heme, which is part of hemoglobin, has been identified in there as well as collagen. This is the story that actually we reported previously, collagen that is similar to the collagen of an ostrich.
This is recent, right? This is like about 5 years ago?
Well, this research has been going on for like the last 10 years or so. Yeah, and it remains, however, highly controversial. Although, you know, when another paper is published, often there'll be, you know, press stories about it, not hinting in the slightest bit about the fact that this is hugely controversial. So there's two real stories here. One is that the young Earth creationists have latched onto this scientific story and said, aha, soft tissue, you know, proteins, even red blood cells in a fossilized T-Rex thigh bone. This means that these bones are only thousands of years old, not tens of millions of years old like evolutionists say they are. What they're doing is, you know, they're basically using what is an anomaly, and then they're arriving at a very specific conclusion from that anomaly, essentially saying that everything we think we know about dating and aging is all wrong because there's this anomalous existence of these soft parts inside a T-Rex fossil. So if we take at face value the fact that there are proteins in the T-Rex fossil, then all that means is that there may be a way, you know, in terms of conditions and preservation for proteins to survive longer than we thought was possible. And while that is certainly a very interesting anomaly, we can't automatically conclude from that everything we think we know about dating methods and the fossilization process must therefore be wrong. Essentially what that means is, well, there's something we don't know about that's going on here. There is some process or some phenomenon that we don't currently understand going on. But creationists and deniers and pseudoscientists generally like to make arguments based upon what we don't know.
The God of the Gaps argument.
It's a form of the God of the Gaps argument.
Yeah, not to jump into a creationist versus evolution debate, but, you know, it just cracks me up the way the young Earth creationists always are using the God of the Gaps, you know, right on the sidelines, ready to jump all the time. Yet whenever the magnifying glass is turned around on them, they offer the most anemic forms of supposed proof for their position at all. You know, it just never fails to aggravate me, frankly.
Yeah,
they're just taking pot shots at the,
exactly.
at the mainstream science. They're not,
what
they're
else not
putting
do they have, guys?
Yeah, they don't have anything themselves to put forward.
Of course not. And I would love to see the Homer's Iliad. I've read it a few times. I don't remember any references to T-Rex or Velociraptors running around outside of Troy anyway.
Yeah,
I think it would have made into the reference books.
The other side of this story is that the scientific community has not essentially settled on a consensus that these proteins are actually millions of years old and that they're T-Rex proteins. In fact, again, what we have essentially is one research group coming out with information, but it hasn't been replicated. It hasn't been broadly accepted. And there is, in fact, very serious skepticism about these claims. One of the criticisms is that it's possible that these proteins are in fact just a biofilm of bacteria, and that this possibility has not been adequately ruled out by the evidence that has been put forward so far.
You mean it was like the excavation was contaminated, Steve?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Or that, you know, bacteria could just be living inside these rocks.
Right? They could have gotten there 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Bacteria live under the earth. The other possibility is that it's contamination in the lab equipment itself. So, and some researchers have pointed out that the lab that did the mass spectroscopy that found the ostrich heme and the ostrich-like, you know, collagen also did research with actual ostrich material, and that they can't rule out that there was some contamination from that. So what they would like to see happen is the same specimens, or, you know, specimens from the same T-Rex fossil thigh bone go to independent labs to see if they come up with the same results. However, this fossil is in the hands of a paleontologist by the name of Jack Horner, and he's not releasing it to any other researchers.
Has he given a rationale why?
Not that I've seen. I'm sure he has, but as far as I could dig up, I haven't seen why he's doing that. He's so far only releasing it to Schweitzer and her research team. This is still very controversial. It's far from established. The other researchers that I've heard from think that this is all BS. This is all just contamination and bacteria, and, you know, and that Schweitzer has not demonstrated 60 million year old T-Rex proteins. So it's hard to use that as an argument against the age of the millions of years of age of T-Rex that the young Earth creationists are doing. And even Schweitzer herself, who obviously believes her own research, who is also a Christian, an evangelical Christian, says that the young Earth creationists are abusing her research and are misrepresenting its implications, and it doesn't imply that at all. So, but they're, you know, again, they're just latching on to, oh, something anomalous. Let's use this to cast doubt upon what the scientists say. Well, Evan, you are joining us a little late, but thanks for coming in.
Sorry I'm late.
Yeah, thanks for making the effort, Evan.
It's all right, Ev. Don't worry about it.
We're still trying to work. Evan's got a new job. We're still trying to work out the schedule.
Yeah, some of us work for a living, yes.
Yes, that's right. Unfortunately, we got these pesky day jobs.
Hey, if I can make it in after a night of karaoke.
Yeah, man.
Just get work.
What did you sing? I have to know. What did you sing?
Don't Stop Believing with my friend Chris.
Oh,
rocked it out. It was impressive.
You are just a small town girl.
It's true. That song makes no sense. I don't know if you've ever seen the lyrics, but it's like streetlight people.
Yeah, it does. It means people that go out at night and are looking to hook up, and two
like
people meet
hookers?
Each other.
Yeah.
See, whenever I hear that song now, I think of The Sopranos. I can't think of anything else.
See, I think, yeah, I think its current popularity at karaoke, though, is Glee related.
Now, we have an audio question this week. Listener Emerson White has actually recorded his question for us. And this is something that we've requested of our listeners before. The reason why we haven't used more of them, well, they sort of stopped coming in, but unfortunately, the audio quality was just terrible, to be frank, and we just felt we couldn't use them. We do like to play audio questions from our listeners, but we also would like you to do your best to give us a good audio recording so that we can play it on the show. So let's listen to Emerson's question.
Hi, Rogues. I'm having a bit of an ethical, moral, skeptical dilemma. Through Facebook, I recently realized that one of the people I went to high school with was a huge fan of Darwin. And being a fan of Darwin myself, I decided to strike up a conversation. It went well, had a good conversation, until about two-thirds of the way through, I asked her what she was doing, and she informed me that she was working with monkeys in Washington State. I asked her what experiments she was doing, and she told me that they were running a battery of cognitive tests and taking gut biopsies. Now, doubtlessly, it's occurred to you what is happening, but it didn't occur to me at the time, and I asked her if these measurements had anything to do with each other. She told me that they did, in fact, and asked me if I knew who Andrew Wakefield was. Instantly, I realized my oversight, and so I endeavored to end the conversation politely. I informed her that I did know who Andrew Wakefield was, but I didn't divulge my opinions of his research. Should I say anything? It seems to me like this could hurt her career, working with Wakefield. And I feel like I should say something, but at the same time, I think she has a lot of respect for Wakefield, and I wouldn't want to just throw away a friendship. Thanks, Rogues.
Hmm. Well, you guys have all this.
Yeah, that's good luck with that.
This is one of those Dear Rogues questions. So, for background, most of our listeners probably know Andrew Wakefield is the infamous British researcher who wrote that Lancet paper about 10 years ago questioning a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. That paper was later discredited. It was actually, in fact, withdrawn by The Lancet, and he was struck off the list of medical practitioners in the UK, now is in the United States, continuing to look for a dubious connection between vaccines and autism, and has become the darling of the anti-vaccine community. Not, in my opinion, the kind of guy you would want to hitch your research career to.
No, no. I mean, at very least, he's still friends with this person, right?
Yeah. It sounds like Emerson is friends with the person, yeah, that he is working in this lab with, at least doing research. I don't know if Andrew Wakefield's working directly in the lab or if it's just part of his research program.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that any skeptic worth his salt should not be able to stop themselves from having the conversation that needs to take place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He needs to educate that person. He needs to take the time and be gentle about it, but absolutely give your friend as much information and let them know to what extent this man has actually hurt people.
Is it possible that his friend doesn't know that?
Yeah,
that's possible. Has been barred and everything. I mean,
it's possible, but man, you'd have to kind of be asleep.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of it. Realize that from the perspective of what is he going to say to her that could possibly have any impact that she wouldn't have heard before.
Well, assuming she hasn't heard before, I mean, I agree with Jay. It's always, you want communication here, at least, put the information out there. There's so many reputable, peer-reviewed sources that talk about this guy and talk about the research. If our listener values any potential of having a friendship here because they have certain things in common, I think they definitely should communicate it. Just send the links. Don't even be preachy. Just send some of the links. Say, just check this out and understand. Here is the situation. Here is the perception. Here are some of the facts. And, let's chat about it. And if she wants to shut him down at that point, well, there's 6.5 billion people in the world. You got other friends.
We get these emails a lot. And from one point of view, I think if someone's really a valuable friend, why would this threaten your friendship? You're coming to them with a concern you have for them and their career, and you're coming from a certain point of view. You should be able to, I think, disagree about scientific questions with your friends without it threatening your friendship. And just approach it in a respectful way. Don't come at the person saying, oh, my God, what kind of an idiot are you? Just say, right. I've been thinking about this. You're working with Andrew Wakefield, and this is the information I've got. What do you think about this? Have you seen this? And the other thing is, I think the worst case scenario in a case like this would be for this to blow up in his friend's face, and they then say, "Well, why didn't you warn me? Why, why am I only hearing about this now? Why didn't you tell me about this before when I could have gotten out?" That's a friendship killer, or potentially, letting the person, again tie their research career to somebody dubious like Andrew Wakefield and not giving them a heads up.
Steve, I agree, but let me ask you a question. I mean, you guys have dealt with the subject of the anti-vaccine crowd a lot. And, you know, actually, I just last month I had an article published in The Humanist called America's Addiction to Belief. And I didn't specifically talk about the anti-vaccine crowd, but they definitely fall into that. The creationist crowd, the truther crowd, the birther crowd, and so forth. People who you can't often have calm conversations. That mm-hmm. they immediately go to a knee-jerk emotional attack posture right away.
Yeah.
And now you guys have covered this subject a lot. Have you often, I mean, what do you think, if this person, as Rebecca said, I mean, it's unlikely that they wouldn't know. Is this, if our listener can actually have a good conversation, an open, honest, cogent conversation without emotion and just discuss some of the facts and hey, I've even agreed to disagree if necessary. But in my experience, a lot of people who are in that belief crowd, and I'm not even talking about religion, they very rarely seem capable or at least willing to have a calm discussion or to entertain more than one idea in their head.
Well, we have talked about this in the past, and I've used this analogy in I've done a talk about sort of how to have interpersonal relationships with people who believe weird things without, you know, losing friendships and while still maintaining your, you know, Skeptic of the Month card. And I think the idea is presenting the facts and walking away. You know, you plant the seed and you don't try to win an argument because you'll never convince someone face to face. What you can do is give them the information they need to then go away, think it over, and then come to the conclusion themselves.
Yeah.
Preferably the same conclusion that you've got. But
it's a process. It's not an event that you're going to convince them in one shot. And that's so rare where someone's like, yeah, you know, you're right. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
You win.
People's pride is just such a powerful force.
You usually don't see the scales falling from their eyes. Usually that's a process that happens when they're off by themselves. Mm. And it's a long process, you know, that occurs out of sight. So you have to be content, as Rebecca said, plant the seeds, encourage them to question. At least what also I find useful is to show them that the true believers tend to believe a lot of factually incorrect and fanciful, nonsensical things about the quote-unquote other side. And at the very least, you can show them that those kind of simplistic cardboard characterizations of the other side are not true, right? Because you're on the other side and you certainly don't fit whatever, you know, caricature they've manufactured. Therefore, you know, maybe they're not giving you the whole picture, you know?
And I think also one other thing on that, Steve, is, you know, when you're talking to someone like that, I think it's important to emphasize that they like to characterize, say, our side. Well, you people have your beliefs too, but it's really not about beliefs. You know, it's about evidence. Just whatever. Yeah. I don't feel one way or another about vaccines or about the moon landings or stuff like that. It's just what the evidence shows. So if this listener were to introduce it and just say, listen, here's the evidence out there. Just take a look at it. Here's 8 different sources. I'm not trying to push anything on you, but my position, not my belief, my position on this is such because of X, Y, and Z. And now what does your side, or at least, you know, Wakefield, what does he have to stand on here? What kind of evidence shows that he is doing anything credible at all?
Yeah, you can even try to sort of distance yourself from any notion of one side versus the other, and even say, you don't even have to say my position. I often will say my understanding of the information is this. This is my current understanding. I'm always open to new information. I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. I really don't have any stake in it one way or another. I'm just trying to understand what the evidence actually shows. And then you just try to keep it focused on the facts by saying that, what do we really know, you know, that about this question? That, I think, helps to depersonalize it a lot, which, again, should be a generic endeavor when dealing with scientific questions. And if you keep it on that level and away from a personal judgment about people, then I think that's how you can have a disagreement with somebody on a topic like this and still remain friends, right?
Yeah, and invite a mutual open-mindedness. I mean, true skepticism is about being open-minded. You know, just not so open that you're a vacuum.
Well, Evan, since you're joining us late, we're going to do Who's That Noisy at this point in the show. But first, Jay is going to give us the follow-up from last week.
Okay, so I have a correction regarding the Who's That Noisy that Evan played the week prior, which was the first recording of Human Voice. And that actually was won by, I think it's Mountain Hermit. And Trinuk actually wrote in and said, no, I shouldn't have won. The other guy should have won. And then a couple other people mentioned it on the message board, and they were right.
I missed 1 week.
Yeah,
the
I know.
The whole segment goes down. Yeah,
I had to scramble pretty fast. It was a good bet for me to say Trinuk won.
And Mountain Hermit emailed us to say how devastated he was that we stole credit from him. But I think, wasn't it that Trinuk gave like a vague answer, but Mountain Hermit was actually the first one to specifically identify what the recording was?
Yes.
Yeah.
That is correct. Okay, so then I played two other Who's That Noisies, if you guys remember. One of them was a Halloween-based one, which I'll play right now.
A naked American man stole my balloons.
Now, Bob, you knew who that was, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that was which was really funny. I found the kid on, it was not a kid anymore, but I found the actor. His name is Rufus Deacon, and that was from American Werewolf in London. Yeah, he's on IMDb.
Rufus.
Probably my favorite part of that movie. I just absolutely love that scene. And that was guessed by Werecow on the message boards correctly.
Which makes sense.
Appropriately.
Good job, Werecow.
Lycanthropes there.
Werefish.
Now, did any of you guys guess what the second sound was? Because I may be wrong, but I didn't see any emails come in or anything on the message board that actually guessed what the other Who's That Noisy was.
I forget what it was. Play it.
This was a really, really cool Who's That Noisy. I really thought it was awesome. This actually is the sound of the sun. And precisely, the technique used is known as solar magnetoseismology, and it's similar to the seismology methods used by geologists studying earthquakes. But what they're doing is they're studying the magnetic solar atmosphere. So they basically interpret the magnetic disturbance that makes, and they convert it into sound.
Cool.
Nobody got it.
Fascinating.
Wasn't it obvious?
Well, Evan, do you have something ready for this week?
I do have something ready for this week. And it's good to be back, by the way, I must say.
It's good to have you back.
Good. Here we go.
Drum roll, please.
No, it was not a drum roll.
Interesting.
It was something else. Quite extraordinary, I must say.
All right. Well, thank you, Evan.
Yeah, think about it. Send in your answers. Good luck, everyone.
All right. Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week we come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and we challenge our panel of skeptics to tell us which one's the fake. This week I'm doing it because Steve is very busy with work.
It's not because Steve totally screwed it up last week?
Well, those two things are related, right? I'm too busy, and I figured I'd better hand it off rather than try to rush it again this week.
So this is my second time doing it. I think I did a much better job this time. I learned a lot from the first time.
We shall see.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So are you guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
As I'll ever be.
Okay, item number one. Young couples are better than long-term partners at discerning each other's preferences. Item number two. A recent study shows that gaining muscle mass is easier for those who have gained muscle before. And item number three. In recent studies, it was found that people in their late 20s felt sadder than people in their 60s did after viewing an emotionally distressing scene from a movie. Okay, Brian, you go first.
Well, regarding couples who have been together longer and not knowing enough about each other that a younger couple, I'm actually going to say that's true. Even though it sounds counterintuitive, I'm thinking that maybe it's just the cynic in me, but I'm thinking that maybe they start ignoring each other after a while.
And you just kind of like dial out certain things, and you're just not paying attention to it anymore. You grow, you know, rote with it. Let's see, growing muscle mass. This thing's easier if you've had muscle. I'm going to say that's true also. I'm probably going to kick myself. I'm going to say that the item about people who are in their 20s feeling sad about viewing something distressing, I'm going to change my mind. I'm going to say that the muscle mass is the false one. Because I think that people in their 20s perhaps are more emotional. And they might be more affected by something.
People in their 20s.
You know, the Romeo and Juliet idea, just intense feelings very, very quickly. So I'm going to say, the false one is the middle item about muscle mass.
Okay, Rebecca?
The only one I feel particularly drawn to is the one that says people in their 20s feel sadder than people in their 60s after watching an emotionally distressing scene from a movie. I suspect, having recently reached my 30s, I'm blessed with the wisdom that people in their 20s are emotionless husks of human beings, and that the older you get, the more empathetic you get. The more sentimental, maybe, the more emotional. So I think that that's the false one.
Okay, Steve?
All right. The one about the couples, these are all interesting because you can kind of make a sense of them either way. Young couples might be more, again, into each other in love than couples that have been around for a long time. But then again, you think, you know, the intuitive thing is that couples that have been together for a long time know a lot more about each other. You can kind of make sense of that either way. The one about muscle mass, I'm going to have to disagree with Brian. That's the, you know, maybe I'm wrong on this, but that's the one I feel most confidently is true, partly because that is so much my own personal experience. That having worked out and then stopped for a while and then going back, it seems like you sort of regain what you have gained previously much quicker each time around. So that makes sense to me. The third one about people in their 20s feeling sadder than people in their 60s. Again, you could look at it one of two ways. One is that, as Rebecca says, as people get older, they get more sentimental. However, they also tend to lose their frontal lobes and get more, a little bit flatter, you know. So again, whether you're looking at this more socially or neurologically, I guess. So I can kind of make that one.
I'm more social than neurological. Yeah,
make sense out of that one either way.
So Rebecca, you're saying you're a blubbering idiot as you hit your 30s.
Pretty much. It's been nonstop crying ever since I hit 30.
So I think I'm going to agree with Rebecca and say that the one about the people in their 20s being sadder than people in their 60s is the fiction. I'm going to agree with the muscle one and the long-term partner one.
Mr. Bernstein.
I like Brian's assessment of the one about young couples being better than long-term partners.
You agree with my cynicism?
I don't know if that's necessarily cynicism, but, you know, young couples, it's fresh, new, exciting. You're kind of paying attention to every little detail, right? And you're just more highly in tune, perhaps, and aware. So I think that's entirely plausible. And then I'm going to go with my gut, which told me initially that the one about people in the 20s feeling sadder than people in the 60s did after viewing the emotionally distressing scene, that one's going to be the fiction. I think it's probably just the opposite of that. I think we have a sort of generation of more desensitized people as a younger generation rather than an older, more nostalgic generation of people in their 60s who I think would be emotionally more emotionally attached to things, such as scenes from movies. So I think that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
The young couples, yeah, like Steve said, a lot of these can go either way. You could kind of support multiple points of view. My idea with the young couples is that, that they're just more keyed into seeing preferences. And I think the key word there is discerning. I mean, an older couple might know what, you know, their spouse's preferences are, but actually picking up on new ones, perhaps, I think would be easier for the young couple, if I'm interpreting that right. The second one, Jay, is too ambiguous. I need an answer before I can even decide about number two, because it depends on what you mean. The gaining muscle mass one is easier for those who have gained muscle before. Now, that would be true if you have gained muscle and lost muscle, but you can also interpret that as meaning somebody who's gained muscle but not necessarily lost it, because people are assuming that that's what you mean. But because if you have gained muscle and you still have that muscle, then I would disagree, because a beginner at lifting weights would have an easier time at gaining muscle than somebody who's already got a lot of muscle. It's harder and harder and harder to get more and more muscle. So I think I need an answer to that question. Can you answer that for me, Jay? Are you assuming that muscle has been gained and lost? Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, it is, Bob. The idea on this one is that it's someone who had gained muscle and then lost muscle.
Okay, then that also makes it hard for me, because I've known that for like 30 years. So that falls in the class of, well, it's too obvious, and I know you know that, Jay. So crap. But yeah, basically, I think it's been shown pretty definitively though that once you've gained muscle and lost it, I mean, it's muscle memory. I mean, that's it. You can gain it back much more quickly than it originally took to get it. So I guess I got to go with that. I can't imagine that they would overturn that. So that would mean then that I'd have to choose number three, that people in their 20s feeling sadder than people in their 60s. I would have to say that one is fiction, although I think it would depend on the nature of the emotionally distressing scene. But I'll still say that that one is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that young couples are better than long-term partners at discerning each other's preferences. And Brian did a very good job. You pretty much nailed it. So couples married for an average of 40 years know less about one another's food, movie, and kitchen design preferences than do partners who have been married or in committed relationships for a year or two.
Wait a minute. People have kitchen design preferences?
Yeah, I thought that was
What does that even mean?
I wish that they didn't even have that in there. I'm like, and kitchen design preferences? Like, what the hell?
I mean, do they also have window treatment preferences in it? Come on.
Some people like their kitchens to be a giant hexagon. Yeah.
So 38 young couples aged 19 to 32 and 20 older couples aged 62 to 78. The greatest gap in partner knowledge was in predicting food preferences, an area with particular relevance to daily life. Older couples' knowledge decline partly reflects a tendency by partners to pay increasingly less attention to one another, Brian, because they view their relationship as firmly committed or assume that they have little left to learn about each other, you know, the whole blasé thing the researchers have proposed. It's consistent with the hypothesis that long-term partners in a new study expressed more overconfidence in their knowledge about each other's preferences than people in short relationships did. So
yeah,
I guess they're being less.
It may not be a cynical thing that they don't care. It may just be that, as you say, they think they already know it. So why bother paying attention to it?
Yeah, so now we'll move on to number two. A recent study shows that gaining muscle mass is easier for those who have gained muscle mass before. And Bob, this one, reading this particular article was pretty shocking to me for a number of reasons.
Shit.
However, sadly, Brian, you failed. This one is science.
Okay. I thought it was a little obvious, but no.
Yeah, I put it in there because it was obvious, but I also put it in there because the article said something that a couple of things I didn't know. One of the things it said was that it was that going against what earlier research has shown, which said that there isn't muscle memory, they actually proved that there's muscle memory now, and they found out the mechanism behind it. So check this out.
Well, you're building new muscle fibers, aren't you? I mean, the fibers are there. They just kind of shrink away.
Let me read what I have here.
All right.
Okay. So it basically said that memory is stored as DNA-containing nuclei, which proliferate when a muscle is exercised, right? So contrary – this is the line that killed me. Contrary to previous thinking – those nuclei aren't lost when muscles atrophy. researchers report that the extra nuclei form a type of muscle memory that allows muscles to bounce back quickly when they're retrained. So the findings suggest that exercise early in life could help fend off frailness in the elderly and also raise questions about how long doping athletes should be banned from competition. Because the fact is that muscle cells are huge comparatively, and because the cells are so big, more than one nucleus is needed to supply the DNA templates for making large amounts of the protein that give muscle its strength.
Cool.
And previous research, I know you would love this one, Bob. I had to put it in here. Previous research has demonstrated that with exercise, muscle cells get even bigger by merging with stem cells called satellite cells, which we've also discussed before, which are nestled between muscle fiber cells, right? So the researchers had previously thought that when muscles atrophy, the extra nuclei are killed by cell death called, you know what that's called, Bob?
Apoptosis.
Exactly. But what actually happens is it retains that information. It stays there in the cell. So the next time that somebody works out, that information is there.
Awesome.
So I thought that was so freaking cool.
That is cool. Jay, let me just point out, though, that one thing I've definitely noticed is a trend in the reporting of science news is a tendency to overestimate prior ignorance on the topic or how controversial the new information is. So, you know what I mean? They always say, oh, we didn't know anything about this, and now finally we understand how this works. Or they try to say, this runs contrary to what scientists used to think. That is often trumped up in these news reports, and it doesn't necessarily reflect the actual state of the science.
Okay, so, guys, you did a very good job. Rebecca, Steve, Evan, and Bob all guessed that the last one was the fake, and I just pulled the switcheroo on the 20s and 60s. The truth is that the sadness response actually strengthens with age. And Rebecca, you know, hit that one on the head. In a recent study, people in their 60s felt sadder than people in their 20s did after viewing the emotionally distressing scene from the movie. And the heightened emotional response to sorrow may reflect a greater compassion for other people and may strengthen social bonds, as the researchers have proposed. So this finding is actually very important because it contributes to the idea of the fact that there's a growing body of work showing that emotions don't deteriorate in the elderly, that their emotions are actually could intensify.
But let me give my neurological interpretation of that, because the frontal lobe atrophy can cause two different kinds of syndromes. You can get kind of a flat apathetic syndrome, or you can get a disinhibited syndrome. So maybe what this is saying is that the kind of frontal lobe atrophy that typically occurs with aging tends to cause more disinhibition of emotions, right? So people are less able to control their emotions, or they're more unhinged, if you will. But I'm just speculating.
Couple other interesting things that the researcher said trying to explain why this might be is that it said that sadness is a very functional emotion, and it's an emotion that really brings people towards us and motivates them to help us.
Right.
So good job, guys. Brian, you basically chose the muscle gaining one first,
and then
you
went
switched
back
to Then you went back. You guys almost swept me.
It's one of those things that was, like I said, it was just one of those things that was too obvious. I'm like, well done.
It's the analysis that matters more than what your final answer is, and you have a good analysis. Of course, I say that because I have one of the worst, if not the worst, records in this game.
So even though you guys really did see right through, and you guys are very hard to fool, I did feel like I did a better job at composing these.
You did.
Than Steve, yeah.
No, right. These were better than your previous one, and they were better than mine.
Oh, better than your previous one.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, man, it's hard.
Well done.
It's hard to pick which one to pull the switcheroo on. Now, I actually called up a few people today. I called up Larry and Jack and to ask for help with this.
Who were they?
So I actually called a couple of friends and ran
You phoned a friend?
These three by them. Yeah, I did.
Used a lifeline.
And asked them to see what they did, and one guy got it and one guy didn't get it. And actually Courtney, my girlfriend, got the correct answer right too. But what would you guys have done if I switched the fake with the muscle mass one and left the age-related sadness one normal? Do you think that you would have stumbled on the muscle mass one?
That was the one I was most certain about.
Yeah,
I would have been shocked if that were the wrong one.
Shocked.
So I think if you had flipped it, I would have. Yeah. That would have made it easier for me. I actually was flip-flopping between 1 and 3 on this one. But if you made the Muscle Mass one the fiction, I think that would have been easier. But you did a good job.
Well done. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
Evan, are you going to take over for Jay for the quote this week?
Would you like me to?
Sure. Evan, I'm not 100% sure we haven't used this quote before, but I like it so much, I don't mind if we repeat it, so go ahead.
Outstanding. Then let's go ahead and do this. Ready? In science, fact can only mean confirmed to such a degree that it would be perverse to withhold provisional assent. I suppose that apples might start to rise tomorrow, but the possibility does not merit equal time in physics classrooms. Stephen J. Gould.
Ah, Stephen Gould.
Very nice. Very nice.
That is an excellent quote from him.
That's great. And all I can think of is creationism.
The whole framing of that as far as in a classroom, equal time in a classroom. That's very, very relevant.
But like, it captures it exactly. And this is one of the things I loved about reading Gould is you could tell he sort of worked over a phrase and came up with a very elegant and concise way of capturing the essence of a concept that is very, very important. The notion that you know, there is nothing that's 100% absolutely true in science, but there are things that are so well established that it would be perverse to withhold provisional assent. That's a perfect phrase, in my opinion.
We lost him too soon. I mean, it was such a shock when he left.
Friggin' cancer. Too bad he wasn't a mummy.
What cures cancer?
All right, I have an announcement.
All right.
You're pregnant.
Yes.
Oh, it's Rebecca. That's my line when you say you have an announcement.
We've mentioned on the show a few times that we encourage people to start blogs and to pick niche topics that aren't being covered. You know, all the major podcasts and blogs, we pretty much circulate through the same limited number of news items and everything. And it's always really cool when somebody just comes up with a niche that hasn't been filled before. And someone contacted me on Facebook, and this gentleman's name is Noah Nez, and he has a blog called nativeskeptic.blogspot.com. And I read a few of his posts, and he focuses on Native American folklore and things that basically pertain to that. It's really cool. He's an excellent writer. He's very intelligent. So I really recommend that you go take a look at his blog. So I'm really excited to read it because he's coming up with stuff that I haven't read about before.
I have a follow-up announcement from last week as well. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe dinner in Sydney, Australia. Some more details. Actually, I incorrectly said it was going to be Thursday before TAM Australia. It's actually Friday, November 26th, 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. in the Ionic Room at the Sydney Masonic Center. Tickets are $70 per person. They are on sale in the skeptics.com.au website. If you go under the shop tab, the tickets are available there, and I understand they're selling very quickly, so if you want to guarantee that you have a spot, pick up one quickly. And again, the entire cast of the SGU will be there, along with some of our skeptical friends, and we'll have some, as well as just dinner and chatting and that kind of fun stuff, we'll come up with some entertainment. We're still talking about exactly what we're going to do during the dinner, but it'll be fun. All right. Well, Brian, thanks for joining us this week as a guest rogue. It was a lot of fun.
It's always great to be here, Steve. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
And thanks to the rest of you for joining me.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Steve.
Our pleasure.
Fun
thanks,
as
Steve.
Always. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.